From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Leiden. This episode, When Treatment Means Prison.
Yes, for some people, maybe it's better than being on the street, but that doesn't mean that anybody should find this acceptable.
Also, robots making music. And the poetry of the Los Angeles River, also the harrowing story of a woman trapped in a polygamist extremist cult.
My view of the world was that everything on the outside world was absolute evil.
And the music of Mali's superstar, Sidi Touré.
Blues originally came from Africa, so if blues has gone back to Africa, then that means it's gone back home.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden.
Fire one, please. Thank you.
The metal doors slide open at the Twin Towers Correctional Facility in downtown Los Angeles, and the concrete towers do loom over the largest municipal jail system in the United States. We watch as four men enter, handcuffed, with a police escort. They're coming in from court. The sheriff's deputies assign them cells. For the duration of their sentences, this is home.
Let's go.
These men are wearing bright blue pants and neon yellow shirts, which sets them apart. Lieutenant Joseph Badali is a supervisor with the sheriff's department.
Here within Twin Towers, we house approximately 3,900 inmates. A majority of those inmates are deemed mentally ill.
In this regard, L.A. County Jail is not unique. Far from it. And that's our cover story today. The mentally ill, patients, and prisoners. Every year, an estimated 2.1 million people are booked into local jails with a serious mental disorder, often for short stays. Once, huge state hospitals housed the mentally ill. When they closed in the 1970s, community-based care was supposed to step in. But instead, the mentally ill were released to the streets, where they often got into trouble. Jails have to take mentally ill offenders in, but they can't force medication.
It's so important that you take your medication, you comply with treatment, because if you don't, you're going to come back here, and we don't want you to come back here.
Right.
Okay?
Psychiatrist Sarah Howe is talking with an inmate through glass. She's chosen to wear a yellow blouse and blue capris today, matching the clothing of the inmates she calls her clients.
All right.
It's good to see you smiling. I'm so happy for you, but keep up the good work.
Because of its size, the L.A. County Jail is the country's largest mental institution. And Howe has held a job here for 15 years. She's now the head of clinical psychiatry. The incarceration of mentally ill people costs taxpayers many millions of dollars. Experts say far more than it costs to treat them in the community. Here in Tower 1, a sheriff's deputy is leading group therapy.
Being a good communicator takes practice. Everyone understand that?
In this pod of the jail, the inmates aren't manacled. They're not considered risky. In another area, the inmates sit handcuffed to a table, quietly watching Iron Man 3. But two of these men are on suicide watch, and they wear only a heavy blue blanket, Howe calls a suicide gown.
It's difficult to shred. It's difficult to manipulate so they can use it as a means of hurting themselves. So it provides greater security.
90% of the mentally ill at Twin Towers also have a substance abuse issue. For as long as they're here, they'll receive counseling.
Clear.
The hospital within the prison opened in 1977, right around the height of deinstitutionalization, when mental hospitals were closing. Gabriel Rodriguez is a registered nurse and works in the unit.
Most of our patients that come up here are very fragile cases, very delicate. They're very ill, and they're refusing to take medications. They're not following treatments. They're not going to court.
That means the staff is watching some truly at-risk people here, as signs make evident.
No sharps, no plastic eating utensils, no wristband, no pencil, no objects patient might use to scratch self.
Right.
There's a 25-year-old man rocking back and forth in his cell. The staff say he's developmentally disabled, mentally ill, and sometimes violent. and he's been in and out of this jail multiple times. And the revolving door syndrome is, to say the least, frustrating for everyone. Again, Nurse Rodriguez.
Spoke to a family member today. He says, you know, we're really burned out. My brother, he comes out 2 weeks out of jail. He's doing fine, and he stops doing medication, and he gets arrested.
Here in the inpatient hospital on the seventh floor, around 30 inmates get treatment. Jail officials say they wish they had many times that number of beds to cope with all the acute cases. I asked Dr. Sarah Howe about this.
This still begs the whole question, are we not turning our prisons into hospitals?
In many ways, we are a hospital. What brought them into the system is an alleged crime, and we certainly at the Department of Health are not here to judge that. But while they're here and they suffer a mental illness, we will provide care.
The county says it's trying to make the best of a tough situation. Columnist Steve Lopez calls it a crime.
For some people, maybe it's better than being on the street. But that doesn't mean that a jail is a therapeutic environment, and that doesn't mean that this is good public policy, and it doesn't mean that anybody should find this acceptable.
Steve Lopez is a writer for the LA Times. He's put county mental health here on the national radar. A series of his columns about a homeless violinist with mental problems became a film. Lopez says it's simple. Jail is no place for treatment, and research backs that up. The list of potential harm to the already sick is a long one. According to the Justice Department, people with psychological disorders are much more likely to be sexually victimized by fellow inmates. And the sheer size of this population makes it a target. There are multiple federal investigations of abuse in the county jail system, and that includes Twin Towers, though it's another jail, the Men's Central Jail, which has attracted notoriety. In response to the federal investigation, the L.A. County Department of Mental Health told NPR, "We look forward to continuing collaboration in assessing and improving our services." Steve Lopez says that once treated, stabilized, and released to the outside world, there are no guarantees for the mentally ill population.
Okay, what happens to people when they've done their time and they're dismissed? What then? Well, the sad news is that the majority of them are turned out onto the streets with no linkage to any kind of community-based treatment center, and this is a population that needs regular management. You know, that jail is not far from Skid Row, and somebody who comes out can take a short walk and end up, you know, in an outdoor drug market and fall immediately back into the same patterns that got them into jail in the first place.
We met one man who's done just that many times.
My name's James Puntar.
James Puntar is 53. He grew up in Southern California and says he started doing drugs when he was just 9 years old. His addictions only got worse.
By junior high school, I was eating acid, and by high school, I was smoking PCP. And then
Puntar is the first person to admit he's made a lot of bad choices with his life. For many years, he lived on the streets, homeless. He's been arrested for drunk driving and petty theft. He made money dealing drugs. He's been in Twin Towers. Puntar also has chronic mental illness and a hodgepodge of diagnoses.
Schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, mood swings, bipolar. I mean, I've seen a lot of doctors.
Inside jail, Puntar says he got help, medications, and therapy. But it can be costly or difficult or all but impossible to stay on a med schedule, unsupervised. And Puntar told us he soon abused drugs again outside. They did not quiet his mind.
I'd be in the store, and I'd have money, and I'd hear people saying, "He's in the bathroom, let's rob him." And I would barricade myself into the bathroom in the store. And the manager's out there, "Come out of there. It's the manager." And I'm like, "How do I know it's the manager?"
There were times when he couldn't find somewhere warm to sleep or the money to eat. And in those moments, he said, he thought about going back to the one place he could always count on.
I actually went to the store and I said, "Well, what's the lowest level offense that I could commit to go to jail?" And then I could, you know, have some food and get my head back together.
James Puntar says he now has 2 years sober. A nonprofit group called the Integrated Recovery Network provides him with housing and mental health services. And he's working towards becoming an addiction counselor. But he is 53 years old, and he says he's taking life one day at a time.
People my age, they got jobs they've retired from. They got houses. They got kids who are grown and married. You know, me, I got nothing. I never had a wife, never had kids, You know, I was married to drugs, and my home that I had built for myself was prison. It was always there. It's there right now.
We have to remember that it is not the jail's choice to take these people.
Dr. Linda Teplin is professor of psychiatry at Northwestern University. She has researched incarceration and mental illness for more than three decades. Perhaps, she suggests, it's the jails that have come the furthest in that time.
Jails have been very good nationwide now about recognizing the need to screen for severe mental disorder and also to provide treatment. This is certainly not a cheaper system, but it is easier to fund the building of new correctional facilities than it is to obtain funds to provide mental health care in the community.
What role would you say that stigma plays in these decisions?
People with severe mental illnesses on the street are not the poster child for people with mental disorders. They may engage in bizarre behavior, walking down the middle of the street on a hot July night wearing a ski jacket. Many people are afraid of persons with severe mental illnesses who exhibit these symptoms. They're not a sympathetic group.
People throughout the system have acknowledged for a long time that it's not working properly. What would it take for this policy to change?
If we had a major public figure take leadership in this area, perhaps because of an ill family member, I think that would do a lot to alert the public's sensitivity to the plight of people with severe mental illnesses being arrested instead of treated.
There are signs of change. Many cities have added training for police and created mental health courts that divert people from jail. But day centers and community centers around the country are often struggling, trying to raise funds to improve services and acceptance. The new Obama health care law may improve access to mental health care. That's certainly the hope. But LA County is also exploring another option, building a new jail at a cost of more than $1 billion. It would have one chief purpose, housing and caring for inmates who are mentally ill. This is NPR News. Robots may not be taking over the planet yet, but they sure are busy in more and more places. Hospitals, offices, movie sets, even battlefields. Now, as NPR's Priska Neely reports, they're also making music.
Compressor Head is billed as the world's heaviest metal band. Three hulking metallic machines. In January, the robot band got to play their biggest stage yet at Big Day Out, an Australian music festival. Thousands of fans rocked out in the blazing sun to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the Killers, and the robot band they'd never heard of. When it comes to their looks, there are a few upgrades to the basic human frame. The mohawked robo-drummer has four arms. It covers the whole 14-piece drum set at once and fires beats off mechanically like a typewriter. The robot guitarist has 78 hydraulic fingers. Wires stream out from the arms to trigger notes along the entire fretboard. With all of the extra extremities, they can play with more speed and agility than people ever dreamed of. And they're not the only robot band out there.
I believe that robots have the capability to be similarly transformative to the guitar, the synthesizer.
Troy Rogers is a composer and instrument designer studying at the University of Virginia. He programs and tinkers with robots out of a small storage unit in Charlottesville. When I show up there, he's busy grinding a homemade blend of coffee called Robot Roast using a hand crank.
Hand cranked, pedal-powered coffee for the creation of musical robots.
Seems like you should build a robot to do this for you.
Maybe eventually.
For now, Rogers and two colleagues are focused on musical robots.
Flip the switch and turn them on. And that's Kari telling us everything is all right.
Kari looks a bit like a clarinet, aside from all the wires and flashing lights. There's a robotic drum and a guitar robot with only one string and two speakers that look a bit like eyes. With the click of a mouse, you've got a band. These robots don't always play the songs the same way. They were designed to improvise. This project started a few years back. Rogers was working in Belgium with another set of robots, the world's largest robot orchestra, at the Logos Foundation. Two human musicians, a saxophonist and a bassoonist, wanted to jam with the robot orchestra. Rogers programmed a section of the orchestra to listen to the patterns of the human performers in terms of pitch, rhythm, and timbre.
It was this sort of free improvisation. I didn't know what they were going to play. They didn't know what the robots were going
to
do.
The music may sound a little chaotic to you and me, but the robots were freestyling, tracking intervals, and responding with appropriate notes. Rogers says for him, the first session was magical.
We were all just sitting there with our, jaws dropped after the fact. And we said, we got to do this again.
Rogers and his team got to work designing a trio of musical robots for the human musicians. Since then, that band has done three tours with the robotic accompaniment.
The more people who get their hands on these instruments and do interesting things, that's how instruments evolve.
Instruments evolving. Here is where the fear of a robot takeover inevitably sets in. Robots can scan endless pages of music and can be programmed with the rules of a genre. If they can play faster and even tour, will there come a time when human musicians are replaced altogether? Well, the humans who are building these robots don't think we are in jeopardy. The goal is collaboration. Bjork commissioned a massive robotic harp for her latest tour. Jazz guitarist Pat Metheny recorded an album with dozens of robotic instruments. He says working with the robots got him to places he's never been. Priska Neely, NPR News.
When you think about the noir genre, you think hard-boiled detectives and femme fatales on darkened city streets. What better place to imbibe noir than in Los Angeles, city of Raymond Chandler and Detective Philip Marlowe? But noir poetry? Meet the daughter of a California pioneer, a local legend, and a woman who's turned her life's misadventures into edgy poetics.
My name is Suzanne Lummis. We are now, all of us, sitting on the Los Angeles riverbed, a section of it that is covered with concrete.
Suzanne Lummis wears turquoise cowboy boots, a peaked cowboy hat, and brilliant lipstick that contrasts with her hair and pale skin. We're perched by one of the most abused rivers in America. Here, a trickle, really, of skanky water flowing through concrete. It's our inspiration.
What draws you to this gritty scene before us, although I think it's gritty beautiful, because you've got the water flowing through these steep walls, which I've only ever seen used for car chase scenes. Why are you here?
I think there is an intensity and a depth in fierce, hard landscapes. I also think there's another kind of intensity in beauty and serenity. And I'm not opposed to beauty and serenity. It just happens that that's not the landscape I live in.
Maybe we should start by reading a poem.
Okay, now taking the contrarian point of view, which is in itself rather a noir sensibility to be contrarian, I wrote a poem called Why I Am Not the Los Angeles River. I don't trail for miles under cement and steel girder bridges as a spindly brook, then sweep out to spread an inch of melted snow and smoky runoff across a concrete floor the width of several lanes. I'm not the LA River.
Like it. Suzanne Lummis's poem winds around her episodic life.
My molecules don't convert like a comic book hero's. I have no shifty, shadowed other self. I'm not the LA River.
I think noir must mean many things for you, but certainly one of the ideas you like to explore is that Los Angeles is not only a 1950s mid-century golden dream.
Yeah, well, I think that Los Angeles has been likened to both a utopia and dystopia. But the thing is, Los Angeles is certainly one of the cities of the world that was pitched, sold to the rest of the country as a utopia. And some of the people, such as my grandfather, truly believed it.
You know, I'd love to know more about your grandfather. You're a multi-generational Californian. Your grandfather was Charles Lummis. Uh-huh. Tell us about him. He was an editor. He was many things.
Charles Lummis walked across the country from the East Coast, Chillicothe, Ohio, to be specific. 1884, he started his walk. Took him a little under 4 months. He walked down the railroad tracks 20 miles away, stopping off at times in certain Native American pueblos, getting to know the people.
Charles Fletcher Lummis became the first city editor of the LA Times, and his house is, in fact, a historic site. He built it out of river rock, and it's open to the public not far from where we sit in Highland Park. Suzanne never met him. He died in 28, but she's got his bold spirit. She's one third of a poetry ensemble called Nearly Fatal Woman, and she organizes the LA Poetry Festival. Her passion is the noir poem, which she says must link to a crime, and she's had them.
Yes, I got mugged.
What happened?
I had a gun held to my head. I got robbed. The worst thing I lost in that was my grandmother's gold ring, the one that my grandfather had given to my grandmother. I became very interested, surprise, surprise, in writing about violence. The film noir sensibility gave me a way to do that without being sentimental.
She teaches a poetry class at UCLA Extension. As a young woman in Central California, she studied with the American great Philip Levine, who was honored just this week by the American Academy of Poets. For decades, Levine was considered the dean of the Fresno School. That, she says, is where she learned the power of language.
Rich, deep, imagistic, and impacting on the page. When those poems really work, and with my poems really work, there is a dynamic visual charge to the language.
There's a charge to her blue eyes as she reads another poem, Venetian Blinds.
The silence of 2 a.m.'s not talking, I may have to get tough. When he touched it to my head, it seemed somehow like a toy. After, the cop said, yeah, people think that, then they're dead.
We leave Suzanne Lummis down by the river, her muse. Maybe she'll create a school of poetry. She could call it the LA River School. Art can be born of strife and hardship, and sometimes it thrives in spite of it. Sidi Touré is an example of that. He's a superstar in his native country of Mali, but artists there have had a difficult time in the past year and a half. Islamic extremists are fighting for control of the area around Timbuktu in the north of the country. The violence has forced many of the region's artists to flee. In the midst of the strife, Sidi Touré recorded a new album. It's called Alafia, or Peace. He's touring the U.S. now and stopped by member station WBEZ in Chicago with his tour manager and translator, Karima Dowdy. Hello, is this Sidi Touré?
Hi. Oui, je m'appelle Sidi Mohamed Touré.
Hi, I'm Karima.
I asked Touré how the war at home affected his latest album.
Bon, dis-lui que les événements,
I have to say that all of the things that happened in Mali in the last year were very painful. They weren't fun to watch, and they weren't fun to experience. So especially in the north, the musicians from the north weren't able to play their music. So they all came down to Bamako to be able to continue with their professions. And I started this album before all of the horrible things started happening, and I finished it after. So it was my duty to keep going.
Tell me a little bit about the history of the Songhai, would you? It's such an amazing region, dating back to medieval times, an ancient place with a lot of folk traditions. I'd like to know more about it.
Sidi vient du 8e région du Mali.
I come from the town of Gao, which is the Songhai capital. And the Songhai capital is important because we had ancient kings, and they were actually the first kings to bring Islam Guam to our region. You can also find Arabs in Gao, and you can also find Pular people in Gao. But it's like what I sing about in my songs. We've lived together for so many years. We've married each other. We've had children together. We have to learn how to live together.
So please give me a song, a track on this album that really reflects what you're telling me about right now.
Mali,
I would choose the song Mali on the new album, because if Mali has anything worthwhile, it's cultural diversity.
Mali, je t'aime mon pays. I like you, my country.
So there's another song on this album I love called My Takamba, and this is a song about celebration, sharing music on the road. Tell us what a takamba is, would you please?
Que j'ai dit après la pluie.
Takamba is a kind of music that's danced to during happy times. After the rain comes, takamba is danced. When people are joyful, takamba is danced, and people play it at any time when they're happy.
And I understand also that sometimes a takamba will praise a specific person. Is that true? You'll sing the praises of an elder, for example?
Takamba can be used to sing for nobles. And my takamba, I'm really singing for all the nobles of Mali to come together and dance together and have a happy time again to reconcile all our problems.
A song of unity. I'd like you to tell me more about the instruments that we hear in these albums. I mean, we hear some guitar, but there's a lot of regional instruments made even from things that grow there, that we see there. Would you talk to me about some of those?
Well,
first of all, I'll start with this young man sitting next to me, the Ngoni virtuoso, Abdoulaye Kone.
And that is the precursor to the guitar? This is a stringed instrument?
Yes, it's the stringed instrument. It's the traditional guitar.
And what about this calabash? This is like a big gourd that gets made into a drum?
Yes, the calabash is a traditional instrument. And it is a big gourd that you cut in half and you turn it upside down and put it on a flat surface with some sort of towel or something underneath it. And it creates a bass sound and also a percussive sound on the top that, for me personally, I've never heard anywhere else. I love the calabash.
Many American musicians are drawn to your music and the music of Mali. And this fall, you're touring with the Grammy-nominated blues artist Cedric Watson. And I think a lot of listeners might almost hear a blues influence in your music. Did you listen to blues as a young artist?
Bon, dis-lui que vraiment ça c'est une très belle question et une longue question.
That's a very good question. When I put out my very first album, I had an American friend listen to it, and he said, oh, you're playing Mississippi blues. You're playing like John Lee Hooker style. And I said, who's John Lee Hooker? Where's Mississippi? I'd never heard of anything like that. And my friend told me, your song is just like the song How, 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 How for John Lee Hooker.
Donc, un jour.
So one day I was walking around the market in Bamako and I saw a vendor who sells cassette tapes, and I saw one cassette tape that said King of the Blues. And I bought it right away. And that's how I discovered John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, and many others. Boom, 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 boom.
You know, it's delicious that we're speaking to you in Chicago. We, of course, think of that as the home of the blues, having traveled up the Mississippi. Are you going to be playing with any Chicago blues artists?
Ça me fera plaisir,
I would love to. It would be a family affair. We know that blues left Africa, and so if we got to all play together, it would be like a marvelous time. I really hope I can play with some Chicago blues men.
Sidi Touré's new album is called Alafia, and he's on a U.S. tour right now, and we're speaking to him in the great city of Chicago. Sidi Touré, merci beaucoup, mon plaisir.
Merci beaucoup.
In 2007, a breakaway extremist offshoot of the Mormon Church called the Fundamentalist Church of the Latter-day Saints made national news. Its leader, Warren Jeffs, had been convicted of child rape after taking dozens of wives.
Tonight, where a raid is underway at the secret polygamous compound run by the FLDS Church, whose leader, Warren Jeffs, is now in prison.
Jeff was sentenced to a term of life plus 28 years. Rebecca Musser grew up in the FLDS Church under the control of Warren Jeffs and his father, Rulon. When she was 19, she was forced to marry the 85-year-old Rulon Jeffs. She tells her harrowing story of her childhood, her marriage, and her eventual escape in a new book called The Witness Wore Red. Rebecca Musser, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jackie. It's wonderful to be here.
This is an absolutely riveting and tragic tale. You were born in 1976 in Utah into a family where there was already a multiple marriage. I'd like you to just kind of take us back into that family. Your father had two wives. One lived upstairs. You and your mother lived in another part of the house downstairs. This is Salt Lake City. We're not talking about out in the sticks. Tell me a little bit about what that household was like, would you?
My father was a businessman. He was not born and raised in the fundamentalist church, and he was converted to it. He had a wife and five children at the time of his conversion. A couple years later, he married my mother for his second wife, and I am the fifth child of my mother. So I grew up in the middle of a very large family. Because of the situation with my father being in business, he was not open about the fact that he was a polygamist, and his second wife and her children lived in the basement of the house, and his first wife lived in the upstairs of the house. So life for us was what we knew.
Tell me a little bit about the relationship between these families, between the first wife and your family.
My father's first wife did not grow up around polygamy, and the story goes that she at first welcomed my mother into the family, but quickly turned to extreme jealousy, and there was a tremendous amount of physical abuse, and there were also sexual violations going on. In my personal experience, I had an older half-brother who sexually abused me and some of my sisters. And even though his mother found out, I was threatened as a five-year-old little girl. And I grew up with that kind of terror. And I did not tell anyone until I was an adult woman.
So a real nightmare scenario. You were a member of this extremist offshoot, this FLDS church. Now, this is a form of Mormonism. So I want to ask you about this. Different from mainstream Mormonism, which has condemned it. We should make that very clear. Talk a little bit about the teachings and rules of this sect, the FLDS sect that you grew up in.
As a child growing up, as a woman, I was taught that the very highest thing that I could ever hope to attain was to become a mother in Zion, to be perfectly obedient to the prophet, and one day have the opportunity to be placed by a good priesthood man, to be perfectly obedient to him. Knowing what I know now, I look back on many of those teachings and I realize the tremendous amount of mind control that goes into place to keep this kind of a controlled environment maintained. But as a child growing up, that's all that we knew. We were taught these things, and I wanted to be a good priesthood girl who was obedient, who could one day be given this great blessing of marriage so that I could go to heaven.
You know, as subservient as that message is, I'm still certain that it came as a shock when at 19 you were forced to marry an 85-year-old man, the leader himself, Rulon Jeffs. Very hard to imagine what that was like for you. How did it change the way you saw the church and your family?
When I found out that I was going to be married to Rulon Jeffs, it was tremendously hard because on one hand, I had all of this principle going on in my head telling me this is right, this is holy, this is what I've been taught, that I lived for my entire life. And yet, here was this man who was supposed to be God in mortality. And then to see the very human, the very carnal side of this man was incredibly overwhelming, because I could no longer deny the reality of the incongruency, what we were taught versus what was really going on.
When Roulant Jeffs died, his son Warren Jeffs tried to take you as his wife. In the book, you describe confronting him about that. It's a very, very scary conversation. He's very forceful about you and your place as a woman in the church, your duty to obey. What happened after that?
When Roulant Jeffs died, he had 56 wives. Those 56 girls were being told, you must be remarried. So it wasn't just me. So when I faced Warren and he said, I will break you and I will train you to be a good wife, I begged him, please do not do this to me. And he said that I had 1 week and I would be remarried, period. I think that it's important to understand that my view of the world was that everything on the outside world was absolute evil. It wasn't if, it was when the outside world would hurt you. And that if you did leave, you would become the most wicked, the most horrible of people.
So you ran away.
I struggled with the decision of what to do. And I finally just realized I could not say yes to something I no longer agreed with. And I did. I left a note on my bed. I was able to slip out past security guards and get away. And for 10 years, I was the only one from that family who has been able to get out.
Rebecca Musser, eventually you went to the authorities and testified against Warren Jeffs in this trial for child rape. The title of your book is called The Witness Wore Red, and this is a reference to the fact that wearing red is banned in the FLDS Church. Describe what that whole moment of reckoning was like for you.
Facing Warren in the courtroom was the first time that I had seen him after he told me that he would break me. So wearing red, the first time I wore it in the courtroom, was out of defiance. It was to send him a message that I was not broken. It later has been a reminder to me, as I've learned and I've grown, wearing red to me means that I have choice. It's a reminder that I have choice every single day, and I have to act on that choice.
Rebecca Musser, her new book is called The Witness Wore Red, The 19th Wife Who Brought Polygamous Cult Leaders to Justice. Rebecca Musser, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the week ending September 15th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Jody Becker. Our intern is Francesca Fenzi. The technical director is Patrick Murray. Mathoni Maturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Lydon. Tune in next week for our new program host, Arun Roth. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.